Hi, everyone, and welcome to today's Flint briefing call, where we'll be discussing some of the hottest political issues of the year concerning the future of Europe's green transition and how the EU and geopolitical developments might have a ripple effect in the UK. I'm Ivana Bartolac, manager leading on our energy and sustainability work in Brussels. I'm joined today by three Flint experts. Gregor Kreutzhuber, partner and managing director for Europe and formerly a European Commission official. Josh Buckland, partner supporting clients on energy, climate and sustainability issues, based in London and formerly an energy advisor in the UK government. And Julian King, specialist partner, formerly UK's EU commissioner, responsible for EU policy on security, cyber and other important aspects of tech and data. Before we start, just a few housekeeping rules. So the call will last for maximum 30 minutes. There is no possibility to ask questions directly, but you can always contact the speakers later if you wish to discuss further. Now turning to the content of today's call. The EU has adopted an extensive amount of climate legislation under the current mandate. The war in Ukraine and the energy crisis have played a major role in accelerating deployment of renewable energy in Europe. The mood has now shifted from a sense of urgency to secure sufficient gas supplies to competitiveness, countering the effects of the US Inflation Reduction Act and addressing dependencies on third countries. The Green Deal has faced a strong backlash. Many are wondering what the EU elections in June and the next mandate will actually mean for the EU sustainability and energy agenda. In the UK, energy and climate policy remain an area of live political debate, with the impacts and costs of the transition becoming a focus in the run-up to this year's general election. Government is considering major reforms to the energy market and moving ahead with CCUS and hydrogen projects. Although the pace of the transition will come under further scrutiny, a potential Labour government would inject further momentum in the agenda, including on the wider sustainability side. So these are some of the issues we want to cover in the next 20 minutes. So I suggest we dive right in. To kick us off, Gregor, we have the EU elections coming up. Why is it that we expect a backtracking on the EU's climate ambitions in the next mandate? Will this really affect the targets set out under the current mandate?
Thank you, Ivana, and good morning from Brussels. Yes, indeed. I mean, I think we've all seen clearly over the latest weeks and months that the Green Deal seems to be going out of fashion to a certain extent. There's a lot of talk about climate backlash in Brussels and in the European capitals. And there seems to be a clear trend towards a pushback across Europe against further regulation, sustainability and climate. So that is a fact. That's a political fact. I think part of the reason for that is that public opinion in Europe is increasingly opposing the regulatory burden and the costs associated with the green transition. This is in turn fueling the rise of populist political parties to the right and to the left. And we will see that also in what's going to happen in the European Parliament election beginning of June. And some governments in the European Union are calling for a regulatory pause on sustainability. So the feeling, the mood music is that one has gone maybe too far, has been too overly ambitious with the Green Deal in the past. We have seen this recently with many Green Deal files, for example, the revision of the chemical regulation REACH, sustainability reporting, the nature restoration law, just to name a few, which all have been one way or the other watered down significantly or even killed by the very Commission. Climate legislation is certainly not easy to implement, and especially not politically when it starts really hurting and biting. And now that the time has come to implement it in a geopolitically very volatile context, and Julian is going to talk about that later, it is not at the top of the agenda anymore. So I think that it's clear that Europe's industry is under pressure because of the worsening security and geopolitical and economic context. In addition, vulnerabilities are aggravated by assertive industrial policy, massive foreign subsidies, local content requirements adopted by third countries, which can lead to unfair competition and trade distortion. So all that plays into the current policy and political environment we see here in Brussels. And the European Union is clearly operating in a context of competing priorities. I mean, that's clear, faced with challenges regarding reindustrialization, having and wanting to support Ukraine, which costs a lot of money, upping Europe's defense and security capabilities, EU enlargement. So there's a lot on the agenda in Brussels at the moment, and governments are ready to commit a significant level of public spending through subsidies and state aid to achieve the objectives, but we'll have to make choices and trade-offs. And that's, I think, the big challenge. If you look at the European Council and the EU leaders and what they decided and discussed last week, for example, if you look at the report of former Italian Prime Minister Enrico Letta on the single market and what needs to be done, it is clear that we'll see a reprioritization towards competitiveness in the next term of the European Commission. But make no mistake, despite the political backlash, the European climate law is legally binding. So there's a lot of things which have already been agreed, and they are here to stay. And the next European Commission is obliged to present its 2040 climate target. So these things are still going to happen, despite what I've just said. And the next Commission mandate will be about simplifying the process of achieving targets, but it will be not about what we do, but how we do it rather, and how we implement it, and how to maintain the speed in implementation, and how to decide who has to bear the costs, which is obviously politically very, very difficult. And also, last point, it remains to be seen if President von der Leyen will pivot back to a greener agenda as and when she has clinched the Commission presidency again. Back to you, Ivana.
Thanks, Gregor. It would be interesting also to see how this compares to the current direction of travel in the UK. Josh, what are we currently seeing in the UK? Do we expect the new government to backtrack on climate ambitions?
Thanks, Ivana, and good morning from London. I think, as we might expect, the context in Westminster is relatively similar to the context that Gregor has described a few hundred miles away in Brussels. And the UK has obviously enjoyed nearly 20 years of a strong cross-party consensus on the need to tackle climate change. But there are some early signs that this is starting to fray as we head towards what is going to be a really significant general election at some point this year, exactly when we're still not quite sure. And that will no doubt signal the first change in power between the two main parties for nearly 15 years. And big issues like the climate agenda are therefore top of the political debate. The political kind of issues around the net zero and green agenda have been driven and focused on by the current Conservative government. But as Gregor described in the EU context, there is also a hostile public debate starting on the costs and the speed of the transition. And there's growing support for fringe parties like the Reform Party that are focused on that, and also the implications for the UK prioritising the green agenda over other issues. So despite the UK hosting COP26 and despite being one of the first countries to pass net zero into law, the current Prime Minister has cottoned on to that public shift and has recently signalled a shift in approach to a more pragmatic approach to green policies, ensuring that customers and bill payers are not impacted by the transition and that UK companies are not made uncompetitive. That has already led to some marquee policies being watered down. We've seen the recent decision to move back the date for phasing out internal combustion engine vehicles from 2030 to 2035. We've also seen the government back away from pushing households to replace gas boilers with low carbon forms of heating. And that matters in the UK, given over 80% of homes are heated by gas. And it's also delayed other measures on wider sustainability policy. And while those changes actually haven't had a huge impact on the overall direction of travel towards clean energy, both given the technology framework and, interestingly, the other supporting policies that haven't been pulled away, it does send a signal both in the UK and plays into that public debate, as well as abroad, including obviously to our EU partners. That theme is going to clearly continue up until the election. The current government are very keen to argue that a new centre-left government led by the Labour Party would not take such a cautionary and pragmatic approach. And the election itself is unlikely also to be the end of it, as Gregor described on the EU side, with a growing debate on the right of politics and the media around the cost of the net zero transition, something that isn't going to end just simply because we have an election this year. So finally, how are the main opposition party, the Labour Party, responding to that? Well, they themselves are obviously being cautious. They're obviously much more keen to talk about the economic opportunities from the green transition and play it as an area that the UK can lead the world in and also potentially strike up new partnerships, including with their EU partners, something I'm sure we'll come on to later. But interestingly, given the public debate and their concerns around what that means at the election, they've already backed away from increasing public spending on the green sector significantly and are therefore, as a result, pushing a policy programme that is actually not that dissimilar to the current government in terms of technology choice and pace. And that's interesting in the context of the fact that actually we will see a very similar set of policy challenges post the election, even if there is a change in government. So I think safe to say it's going to be a similar experience in the UK as we've seen in the EU, and that will be the case whatever the outcome of the election later this year. Back to you, Ivana.
Indeed, it seems like the direction of travel is indeed quite similar. Turning back to you, Gregor, what are some of the key areas that policymakers in Brussels will have to work on to facilitate the clean energy transition? We have seen a really big number of initiatives in the current term, such as the Grids Action Plan, the Wind Power Package, the Electricity Market Design Reform. What are some of the areas where work is still to be done?
I think that sort of in view of what we've discussed a few minutes ago, it is clear that the direction of travel is going to be more about implementation than sort of inventing now yet another set of politically ambitious, or if not to say lofty, objectives, which some may see as unrealistic or overshooting. So it's going to be more about sort of trying to make things work which have been politically decided but haven't been sort of really put into action, which is in itself a massive challenge because 2030 is around the corner. We all know that. There's not much time. There's also a number of areas, to be frank, where the European Union and also the Commission has not quite figured out yet what exactly to do and how to decarbonize separate and different energy sectors. Some important shortcomings have been identified by Letta in his single market report: infrastructure, cross-border interconnectivity, clearly, supply chains for clean tech, and of course, funding, especially private sector funding. I think that's one of the big themes we can expect. How can we make sure that the private sector is investing more? Because nobody's under the illusion here in Brussels that this is not something the public sector can do on its own. Clearly, grids and the question how to improve them and will remain and will be and become an important issue and a priority. Europe is trying to increase the share of renewables, electrify transport, make buildings smart and flexible. You have power-hungry data centers, which will be growing. So this brings questions of interaction between different sectors, such as tech companies, real estate, low-carbon transport, decarbonization of industrial processes, such as cement, glass, steel production, to the fore. And these are all very, very interesting but very complex questions. There will be also a need to ensure consolidation of the connections and collocation of data centers with solar farms, battery storage, wind farms to reduce the number of connections to the grid. And this is not simple to do. That's not easy to do. And the Commission is working on several activities under its grid action plan, such as, for instance, on guidance on sort of anticipatory investments in grid projects. And that's an important, or would be an important, measure. So given the scale of the challenge, this is unlikely, if you ask me, this is unlikely to be enough. And then there are sectors you can't electrify and you will need hydrogen. And the next commission will have to build upon the hydrogen bank, the revised renewable energy directive and other regulatory initiatives I would expect to ensure hydrogen can serve the industry in the future. But there's still this looming question about how good the business case of hydrogen really is in reality. And as I said before, the issue of funding for the green transition is one of the main topics and will be one of the main topics the next EU mandate will have to work on. Significant public funding is needed because many of the required investments for clean tech are not profitable enough for the private sector to finance it alone. But in turn, you also need significant private sector investments, and that's where the challenge is. Letta stressed in his report that we need to build the energy infrastructure, but for that we need more capital, which is basically a slightly obvious statement, but still not easy to put into action. And the current EU funding is clearly not enough, and too complex and too burdensome and too bureaucratic for business to access. So from my point of view, the European Union can't operate a system where it continually relies on massive public debt, because it will not be able to sustain this for long. So public finances are already strained, so that's going to be an issue as well. And how deep member states' pockets are to provide state aid varies significantly across the 27 member states. Consequently, there is also significant concerns about the internal market's incredulity, fragmentation of the single market, unfairness. If you think about the fact that currently in energy, essentially, you know, more than half of all the subsidies at national level in the 27 member states are paid by France and Germany. Voila. Back to you, Ivana.
Thanks, Gregor. So it's interesting to zoom into more specific policy areas. So Josh, I'd be interested to hear how this compares to the UK. What will be on the agenda for UK policymakers? Do you also see any significant developments in perhaps the EU and the UK cooperation on energy-related issues?
Well, I might come back to that last one in a moment, because that's probably the most vexed question. But just on the first around the agenda, that despite the kind of politicisation of the green agenda, there is still an awful lot going on when it comes to energy and climate policy. This year, we're expecting the government to look to sign contracts for a whole series of major clean energy projects that have been in the work for a number of years. There's a critical upcoming auction for renewable power, particularly offshore wind in the UK context, that they hope is going to be a success after a recent failure in a last auction to procure significant amounts of offshore wind. They're also looking to sign initial deals with clusters of carbon capture projects across the UK, as well as secure a landmark deal with EDF on the Sizewell C nuclear plant, strike a whole series of orders for potentially small modular nuclear reactors, as well as also deliver another round of funding for hydrogen projects. There's also the small matter of energy market reform, which there's been a recent consultation on and continues to progress with some potentially significant reforms underneath the framework that's being considered. And so there is still a lot happening. Obviously, in the UK context, that can still progress right up effectively until election day. But obviously, the timing of the election will impact how much this current government can achieve. At the moment, the base case remains that the election in the UK happens in the late autumn. But there is a chance of an earlier election. And clearly, obviously, some of those big commercial deals that they're looking to achieve to try and address and try and accelerate the energy transition could be more difficult in that context. There's obviously also real constraints, and those are constraints that impact this government as well as the next. And interestingly, hearing from Gregor that they're similar in the EU, there's probably two I'd pull out. First, the fiscal position. The impact of the pandemic, the recent energy bill bailouts and creaking public services mean that the current government and the next are grappling with not just what can be progressed, but also how quickly. And that's already leading to trade-offs in terms of which technologies are taken forward and also the size of the ambition. And there's also a growing risk as a result that targets are missed. And a really interesting microcosm of that is recently the Scottish government to change their target to cut carbon emissions by 75% by 2030 and reduced it down to 70%. And just this morning, that's led to the collapse of the governing coalition. So it shows just how the reality of stringent and ambitious climate targets are starting to impact the reality on the ground. And the fiscal position is a key reason for not necessarily being able to deliver against those ambitions. The second challenge I pull out is the way that the UK looks to deliver infrastructure, which we know is challenging. As we've seen across the EU, the US and elsewhere, the planning system for delivering new infrastructure is struggling to cope with just the scale of the projects required. The supply chain is under pressure post-pandemic, as well as also post the recent inflationary pressures. And that includes, obviously, from international competitors. There's also challenges around accessing grid connections for both generators and demand-side customers, and also real issues around accessing the right skilled labour, exasperated, obviously, by the debates we've had on immigration over the course of the last couple of years. And whilst both this government and the next Labour government are talking about deploying more public money to reshore critical supply chains, there is a global race for investment, and therefore any attempt to access greater levels of supply chain investment is clearly a challenge. So that real issue around the overall delivery framework for infrastructure is starting to impact some landmark projects as we speak. Just then, finally, on the issue of UK-EU cooperation on energy, I think this is really a matter for the next government, and let's assume for a moment that the Labour Party do win that election. We know that the Labour government are looking to strengthen ties with the EU, including specifically on energy, but also defence. And the party doesn't want to talk about that before the election, given Brexit still lives long in the mind of many voters, and they know that any strong signal of alignment and cooperation could potentially play bad at the ballot box. But they are keen to reframe the relationship, and one of the early areas of obvious kind of mutual benefit would be on energy. But this will obviously have limits. There's a real question around whether Labour would be willing to accept some level of EU regulatory cooperation, something that would be critical if you're going to make a greater lift on broader economic ties, including in the energy space, looking to link the emissions trading regime, or alternatively, even potentially looking to align on new measures like the carbon border adjustment mechanism that is being developed in the UK and the EU. So I think the context is positive, and I think some of the politics, the immediate politics, have reduced. And a Labour government, if they do come into power, could potentially reframe that relationship. But it's by no means an easy task. Back to you, Ilana.
Thanks, Josh. I think for the last point, it would also be interesting to discuss some more geopolitical aspects of this debate. So over the last few years, the COVID pandemic, the war in Ukraine, and increasingly assertive China have really dramatically reshaped the rules of global trade and diplomacy, sparking sort of a paradigm shift in Europe. This has significantly affected the energy sector and also the development of clean tech in Europe. Economic security has now, especially in Brussels, become a new buzzword. Julian, turning to you, do you think it's fair to assume this will continue in the next mandate? What are some of the key issues to watch out for when it comes to EU's trade policy and economic security?
Well, thank you. And good morning, Ivana, and to Gregor and to Josh as well. So I think you're right. Economic security is very likely to stay high on the agenda, whoever's in charge in the EU. I mean, it's been part of this commission's work under VDL. Others are talking about it as well. Draghi in his recent speech, and we'll see what Macron says about it in his big Europe speech. In other words, it crosses political lines. There are different dimensions. I mean, there's an underlying sense that you just referred to that the EU model, its view of its engagement with the world, is under pressure. The rise of nationalism, populism, given expression in national economic and trade policies around the world, has definitely put pressure on the rule-based order, including the rules of international trade. You only have to look at the gridlock at the WTO. And there's a sense, strong sense, that the EU has been a bit relaxed, too relaxed about access to the single market, to the 450 million citizens and consumers, and that needs to be addressed. So we're seeing various responses. Gregor mentioned the efforts to try and improve the functioning of the single market, to boost competitiveness. But there's also, I think, a conscious look at the way the EU grants access to that single market to others. The debate's also being driven, obviously, by particular international events as well. Russia's invasion of Ukraine, refocused attention on hard defense issues, but also on a wider sense of security. Energy security, obviously, but also economic security, how to build resilience, how to reduce dependencies across key sectors of the economy for key inputs, whether that's oil, energy, all the way through to tech. The situation in Gaza and the wider fallout across the Middle East has again pushed energy and resilience of supply chains right up the agenda. And these recent events, more recent events, are building on a longer-term trend of concern about the behavior of key trade partners, in particular China. China's economic behavior and trade practices, which is still very much in focus. You only have to look at the number of probes being undertaken at the moment by the Commission into China. Anti-subsidy probes on China wind, solar, EVs, anti-dumping on a range of areas, including biodiesel, and now talk of an investigation into unfair procurement practices as well in various sectors. And I think that is going to continue. There's obviously speculation about Trump's potential impact were he returned as president on international trade. And obviously that could be very significant. His people have been talking about a 10% general tariff and a 60% tariff on goods from China, which would have big effects, direct and ripple effects. But the point I want to make is that I think that this move across the EU to focus on terms of access to the single market and these economic security considerations will continue whoever wins, whatever the outcome of the US elections. And the last point I might make is that obviously you can increase resilience, reduce dependencies, but there are limits. For Europe, that's particularly true, perhaps, around energy. As Europe seeks to manage the transition that Gregor in particular has been talking about from historic energy sources, coal, oil, etc., to renewables, they very much still need gas. And well over 90% of natural gas in the EU comes from imports. We've massively reduced across the EU dependency on Russia. Norway and the US are top suppliers last year, but supplies also came from North Africa, Qatar, the UK, in fact, and others, including Azerbaijan. And I think that in the energy field and perhaps in some other fields as well, some dependencies will continue to be reflected in the EU's policies and in its international relationships. And that is inevitable despite the focus on economic security. Back to you, Ivana.
Thank you, Julian. And thank you also, Josh and Gregor, for your great insights. It's clear that the green transition has really become embedded into this volatile geopolitical and economic context, which is, of course, shifting focus towards competitiveness and towards economic security. And I think this has definitely created even more complexities for companies when it comes to understanding new regulation and policies. So this brings us to the end. Thanks to you all for joining. And please don't hesitate to get in touch with any of us on this call if you want to pick up any of the issues covered in more detail. Wishing you all a great day.